Case for argument, United States v. Cannon. Ms. Johnson. Where's Mr. Johnson? Miss Johnson, I mean. Come on, Miss Johnson.
Good morning. This is a case where we are essentially expecting the defendant and the jury to understand a legal distinction between crack and cocaine base when it's clear from the record that, in fact, the trial judge and the attorneys involved in this matter did not understand that difference, despite
Why would there be any need for the jury to understand the difference, given the stipulation?
Because the stipulation is ambiguous on its face and how
it's
ambiguous.
Cocaine base paren crack.
Well, Your Honor, if the stipulation said cocaine, the form of cocaine base that is considered to be crack, that would be clear. But it doesn't say the form of cocaine base that is considered to be crack. It just, you have cocaine base and you have crack in quotes. And
it's
a juror...
It's in parentheses.
What alternative interpretation do you have of that?
Well, a juror and a defendant and anyone who's unclear about the differences between cocaine base and crack could believe that the crack in parentheses is just an explanatory phrase for cocaine base. And in fact, I would suggest that that's what the trial judge believed.
But let's look at it the other way around. This is cocaine base paren crack. And if it were, in fact, one of the other forms of cocaine base, then it's hard to see how anybody would have agreed to the use of the word crack to describe what it was. They would have objected, and they would have said, no, as a matter of fact, I had one of the other forms of cocaine base, not crack. But instead, this says cocaine base paren crack, which it seems to me most reasonably is read as the cocaine base that is crack.
Your Honor, I would suggest that would be the case where people clearly understood that there's a legal and scientific distinction between cocaine base and crack.
But see, what I'm saying is if this man, I think contrary to lots of references in the record, had not been dealing in crack, he would have said there was no crack involved. He wouldn't really have had to know the scientific niceties of what it was he was dealing with, whether it was a base form, whether it was the, you know, salt form, whatever form. He would have just said, there was no crack here. I'm not going to sign the stipulation.
But that's only if he knew that cocaine base, that there's forms of cocaine base that aren't crack.
Not necessarily. I think when he's asked to sign a stipulation that he was dealing in something that included parentheses crack, if he really hadn't been dealing in any crack, he wouldn't have signed the stipulation.
Well, that's... See, what we have here is a scientific distinction.
I understand.
That,
believe me, you know, we've all become chemists,
right,
you know, over the years.
that I would suggest many attorneys don't even understand. Attorneys,
but do you see
advising
what I'm trying
dealers
to say?
Understand whether they're dealing crack or not.
Yeah. Well, and if he had not, see, I'm just trying to ask you to look at it from the other way around. If he had not been dealing in crack, I don't think he could possibly have signed this stipulation.
Well, if he thought that all cocaine was crack, if all cocaine base, I'm sorry, if
but
he thought
any
that
reason
all...
reason to think he thought that? That
well, yes, Your Honor. The fact that the judge constantly referred to the two as interchangeable terms.
But that's... Where do we have any inkling that anyone was confused about, you know, whether little hard rocks of stuff, you know, were being... were what was being talked about instead of these other kind of fancier forms of cocaine base that almost never show up but that are theoretically at least possible?
I'm sorry, if you could repeat that question.
Well, this is really just my basic point. You know, the terminology that they're using is crack. They're calling his attention to the fact that it's crack, and maybe using parentheses is not quite what you would like, but it's hard for me to imagine signing this if crack wasn't involved.
But if client...
Where's the evidence that he was doing anything else?
Well, if... I would suggest that the evidence is in how the judge repeatedly referred to the cocaine base and crack as being interchangeable.
That is not evidence.
Interchangeable terms.
How the judge talks is not evidence. I had the same question as my colleague. Is there any evidence that the form of cocaine base here was anything other than crack?
Well, actually, Your Honor, the drug analyses in these types of cases only say cocaine base. They don't address the question of what type of cocaine base is involved. And I would suggest that there wasn't any scientific evidence about...
Your client knows what he was selling. He presumably could tell his lawyer what he was selling, and they could figure it out and put in the record, if need be, what it was.
Your Honor, the client knows what he's selling only if he made it.
Okay. So the answer is no. There's no evidence. You might want to devote some of your time to the sentencing issues. Your time is short.
Well, in terms of the sentencing issue, we are in agreement with how we understand the government's argument in connection with the Booker case not changing the judge's ability to have discretion in connection with issuing minimum mandatory sentences under the statute. However, we believe that the trial judge's analysis and how he determined that, in fact, Booker did give him that authority was accurate or was a just analysis.
And I don't see how Booker changes the way a district court judge assesses whether a particular defendant's record includes one or two prior convictions. There's a question of, you know, separate proceedings and consolidation and all the rest of it. But how does Booker change the way that happens?
Well, Your Honor...
Isn't it an issue of statutory interpretation?
Your Honor, it's my perspective that...
Because picking a sentence is not the same thing as a statutory interpretation, right? So you have discretion... pick a sentence within the range, but that doesn't mean you can do so by ignoring statutes, right? That doesn't make any sense.
Well, actually, Your Honor, in my reply brief, my wording was very carefully chosen. I believe that the trial judge in this case did the just thing, and I believe that he...
It was just. It just
did
was
he
illegal,
do the legal thing?
Yes, that was unfortunate. Let me ask you, does the Public Defender's Office ever file Anders briefs?
Well,
I've never
Your Honor,
seen one.
Yes, actually, I've filed some Anders briefs. I would...
It's
note
candidate,
that
yeah.
that the last time I conceded an issue, however, I ended up withdrawing it, and it was favorable. There was a favorable ending. In this particular case,
Did your client know when he took this appeal that he was risking a cross appeal by the Solicitor General?
I don't know that I would appropriately answer that particular.
Not asking for any confidences.
question in this context. But I can say with absolute certainty that we fully advise our clients of all of the risks of appeal.
Okay. Well, thank you, Ms. Johnson. Mr. Bass?
Thank you, Your Honors. Good morning. May it please the Court. Timothy Bass on behalf of the United States. Your Honors, despite Judge Baker's admonishment and Judge Easterbrook, there is evidence in the record, or statement by the district court in the record at the conclusion of the sentencing, advising the defendant of the consequence of taking an appeal. And despite that admonishment, the defendant has advanced this direct appeal, laboring under a plain error or a miscarriage of justice standard, to a sentence that the defendant himself ultimately refers to as just. Now, there can be no miscarriage of justice in a just sentence.
It's only just as compared to a life sentence, which is what the Solicitor General has authorized you to argue is the legally required sentence. And I guess my question for you is, how much deference should we give a district court judge's characterization of these priors as either functionally consolidated or not? I mean, this is something where there are factual elements to that kind of question.
Well, Your Honor, I think the facts are what's, with respect to the convictions, are what is laid out in the pre-sentence report.
Well, I realize that, you know, there's a period of time between the two events in his rap sheet, if you will, and different amounts of cocaine. But on the other hand, he's sentenced on the same occasion in the state court. You know, we see these kinds of things under the guidelines, too. And the district judge in each instance has to make a call as to whether it's really one prior, or whether, you know, in which a number of things have been presented, or one course of conduct, or whether it's two.
Well,
and I'm asking how much deference we should give to the district court judge's characterization of that record.
I think you give no deference to the ultimate conclusion, which is a legal conclusion as to whether these two convictions, or these facts, which in this case were not disputed, whether these undisputed facts constitute two prior convictions under the statute. That's a legal determination.
Is there a functional consolidation doctrine under the Armed Career Criminal Act? There is one under the guidelines. Is there one under the Armed Career Criminal Act at all?
Well, Your Honor, this Court has not addressed that issue.
What does the statute say?
Well, the statute says nothing about whether the two prior convictions must be separate from each other or separate from the instant offense other
than
the fact.
If you look at the facts of Hudspeth, the five convictions arose out of events that were separated by about 10 minutes. And the defendants were prosecuted and convicted, tried of the five separate offenses at one time. One would think that if there was some functional consolidation doctrine, Hudspeth would have come out the other way.
Your Honor, the only thing I can say to that is that because this court has not addressed that question, the other cases from the other circuits that we do cite in the brief suggest that there is a determination that needs to be made as to whether the prior convictions are separate.
But
now,
I'm
that's
surprised
an analysis.
You're arguing that. I mean, what Judge Easterbrook is inviting you to argue is that there is no functional consolidation doctrine for this statute, even though there may be under the guidelines, because if there is no functional consolidation, then you easily have the two priors, and this guy's away for life for something on the order of 15 grams of cocaine.
I agree, Your Honor. And
I mean, I'm not saying that is what we have to decide, but I think that's the argument that the government's probably making.
How old is Cannon?
How
was
old
he
is
when he was sentenced?
He was, I'm not sure of his exact age, Your Honor. I believe he was less than 25, between 20 and 25. But to respond more directly to your question, Judge Wood, I recognize that issue in drafting the brief, but it was not necessary to the success of our appeal, because the functional consolidation doctrine arises from Section 4A1.1 of the guidelines.
Right.
And even applying
where
that,
it's actually stated as a rule.
Correct, Your Honor.
But that's why I don't understand why we are having this discussion. Right.
Well, we're having this discussion, Your Honor, because that was the reasoning that Judge Baker found applied to find that this was only one conviction. And all I'm saying to you is
we have an en banc decision, Hudspeth, which took a very different view, which said that the Armed Career Criminal Act was not the same as the guidelines priors approach. Why should we be having a discussion? What is this? A discussion whether to follow Hudspeth? It's a very
Your Honor, I didn't cite Hudspeth in my brief, and I'm not familiar with that case. But this court has not addressed that question under Title 21.
Why, as a matter of prosecutorial discretion, would you bother to appeal? Isn't 20 years enough? I don't understand that. Why do you want to impose on the government the expense of housing this person for the rest of his life? Minor dealer.
Are you asking me why we advanced this appeal?
Why do you bother? I mean, don't you exercise some kind of discretion when you're deciding whether people should have longer sentences? Unless you're just trying to discourage people from appealing. I understand that, you know, filing the intimidating cross appeal. But putting that aside, assuming that's not what you're doing, why would the U.S. attorney want this person to be sentenced to life?
Your Honor, I can only respond to that by stating what I said to Judge Baker at sentencing. This defendant was given every opportunity, multiple opportunities, to avoid the sentence that he ultimately faced at sentencing. And he chose the opposite path. And when it came down to the time of sentencing...
What were his multiple opportunities? I don't understand.
Well, as I referred to at sentencing to Judge Baker, we approached the defendant from the very beginning on the day of his arrest to discuss options for him that would result in him receiving a sentence of less than life.
What were those options? I don't understand.
Well, there was the option of
could be
a motion by the government under 18 U.S.C. 3553E. That was
What did you want from him in exchange for the option? Information? Or you wanted him to be an informant or what?
That is what's referenced in the record, Your Honor, what I stated to Judge Baker. There were opportunities for the defendant to provide information to...
So you say he was uncooperative. Is that the point?
That's correct, Your Honor. There were opportunities, multiple opportunities for him to discuss a plea agreement with the government that would entail pleading guilty, of course, but also cooperating and availing himself of the possibility of a downward departure motion. He chose at every fork in the road to reject that option. And when it came down time to sentencing, and Judge Baker had these facts before him, he says that Booker gives him the discretion to determine whether two convictions are one, and imposed...
No, I understand your argument. Imposed I was just curious about the choice to appeal.
And imposed an unlawful sentence, right. Your Honor, so... Just to complete my answer, given those facts, the government determined that this was an appropriate case to appeal.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Your Honor, very much.
Ms. Johnson, does she have any time left? 1 minute? Do you have anything further, Ms. Johnson?
Your Honor, I would just note that we actually filed a motion to withdraw our notice to appeal this matter, and after the government appealed, then we did the cross appeal. So I left that out.
You're actually, in a sense, the cross appeal. I mean, I know we reshuffled you all, but because of the withdrawn appeal, you're in effect cross appealing the government's appeal.
Right, yeah. Your Honor. So I just thought that might be a more complete answer to the question.
Okay, well, thank you very much. Thank you to both of you.